Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome in to another episode of the Friday Show here on the Second City Hockey Podcast Network. I'm your host, Dave Melton, the site manager here for Second City Hockey. You can find me on Twitter at dmelt57. I've got Eric from Chicago, Eric Eggenheimer, back with me this week. And we've got a recurring guest on a Friday show here for the first time ever. It's Corey Snyder. He's on Twitter at ShutdownLine. He runs the excellent All Three Zones project, which is a really good resource if you're interested in more of the minute details of hockey and really want to get a good grasp on very specific things that hockey players across the NHL do and do not do well. And of course, we did have a little bit of hockey discussion at the beginning of this episode, but what we really got into was a lengthy music discussion between myself and Corey and Eric, because we all have fairly similar overlapping music tastes, and we were just, I guess, feeling a little nostalgic, so we decided to go back 20 years to 2003, and we just played a little game of let's remember some albums. We went around the room a handful of times, tons of music discussions. If you're anywhere into the punk rock or emo world like we all are, this podcast will be a wonderful nostalgic journey for you. And hopefully a lot of you are, because I don't think we venture too far away from those musical stylings. But yeah, it was a great time. It was great to have Corey back. When we talked to him last year, there was a lot of music discussion, so we thought there was no one better to bring on for an episode that really got deeper into the music part of the discussion. And hey, it's mid-August. Hockey's still really far away. It's about to be 9,000 degrees every day in the Chicagoland area next week, so ice hockey is nowhere near the forefront of any of our minds, but music always is. So that's what we talked about. Without any further ado, let's get to the episode. Thanks to you for listening, as always. We got more episodes coming your way. Thanks to Corey for hanging out and being very generous with his time once again, and here's our conversation. I got no regret right now. On these shows, so I don't know if there's like a welcome packet or some sort of distinction we will give you for being a returning guest here, but congratulations on that. So
is it like a Saturday Night Live club?
Yeah,
they get like robes at 4 or 5, something like that.
Yeah, I think it's 5 when you become the big, when you get into the club for SNL host, right? I think that's how that worked. That was the Timberlake bit.
They had the skit, yeah, with like Alec Baldwin and whoever else. I can't remember, but yeah, yes. 5. I think it was 5. Yeah, you're right.
Okay. Well, you've heard Eric, you've heard me, and Corey Snyder is also here with us on the Friday show on the Second City Hockey Podcast Network. Corey, thank you so much for taking the time out. I know it's a bit of a busy time for you and about to get even busier. So thanks again for us finding some time to talk with us once again.
Yeah, it's no problem. Always happy to talk about hockey and music.
Yeah. And I guess, we do have some important stuff to get to in this discussion, and I guess we'll get the hockey stuff out of the way first so we can get to it. I did have one other question. Like, I would encourage people to go back and listen to the conversation we had last year. There was a lot of discussion about what you do and how you do and how you do it and just what kind of role it plays in the hockey world. The thing I'm most curious about, and I don't think we discussed this last year at all, Are you familiar, like, do you know if any NHL teams have used your data or similar data?
Yeah, vaguely. Like, I've had a few people like in those circles kind of reach out to me.
Okay.
And just like to get a handle on what I do and how to handle data that's similar, like what's how to make heads or tails of it exactly. But I've noticed some names that I know are working for teams like on my subscriber list. I don't know if they use data or I don't know if they use my data or if they like just want to support me, but it's kind of always nice and interesting to see. I doubt it's used at like a highly important level though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I would be curious to know if some of the other data that's out there, whether publicly available or through a subscription model, if any of that makes its way to the NHL front offices. Like, I would love to know if they're looking at natural stat trick data. Like, we use that every game because it's the data we have access to. I don't know what other proprietary information is out there, but I would love to know what NHL teams use, because I imagine they have game-by-game reports that come out, like, that night.
Yeah, a lot of it is kind of automated through, like, stat... what is the name of that site?
Sport Logic?
Yeah, I don't know why I totally blanked on that, but Sport Logic does a lot of that. Stathletes does too. I'm like, I'm not sure if like the whole league is like subscribed to it, but you get a gigantic stat package that like I don't even know like where to start or where to begin with it, because there's so much data that they track and it's all so granular. So it's really tough. It's really tough for me to say like what exactly they do. I don't know if they even do it for like single game breakdowns. That just seems like so daunting with how little turnaround you get.
True.
In the NHL. But for free agent signings or like in season adjustments, maybe. I've always been curious about how like the more granular data is worked into, especially like in the off season, as far as like developing players, like where they can get better.
Well, yeah, I'm curious. I think that's something we're going to maybe do a little investigating in that world, hopefully see if we can get some answers related to that, because I imagine NHL teams have their own, you know, like every team has their own analytics staff, and there was like the Hawks just there was a story out that the Hawks have more than anyone else. But I imagine there has to be some acknowledgement of that data that's out there, just because it's out there. So you might as well at least take a look at it and see how it lines up with. I would also be interested in seeing how data such as like a natural stat trick or yours or anyone else's that's out there for the public to see, how much that lines up with the data they're getting inside the rooms within the NHL. I don't know how much they're going to tell us, because hockey teams are notoriously tight-lipped about everything, but, you know, I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, I think I know a lot of teams are hiring people on like the engineering and the more like machine learning type of people, and that's mostly just to kind of organize and kind of make sense of the data. It's a lot of stuff like you need to be like super like, I don't know if qualified is the right word, but like you definitely need to like have a stats or some kind of quant background to work in that kind of field.
Okay.
And I do not have that, so I'm kind of in my own little niche right now.
Okay. Well,
The Blackhawks have posted a job opening earlier for a couple of data scientist positions. And I think Scott Powers or somebody had reposted it. And I kind of took a cursory glance just to see like what they were looking for, because it was kind of interesting to me. And I did not understand half of the things that they had listed for qualifications. So, yeah, it's definitely getting in there, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's like I have like 10, 15, 20, if I'm being generous with the qualifications you need for that kind of stuff. But they do want a lot of school and a lot of experience for what I assume is an entry-level job. So it's a tough field to kind of get into. And I know it's a lot of computer work too, at least from like the data scientists or like engineering type of front in the analytics departments. But like, I know some people get hired. I know some people have been hired as like analysts, and it's a lot more like practical work with the data as opposed to just number crunching or like coding and stuff. So I've always been interested in that, like how they bridge the gap between the two. So I assume it's a lot of like, it's a lot of complex info. You have to kind of translate to the hockey people when making decisions.
Yeah, they had that video they released. I think it was before the draft where they were talking to all the scouts at the table. And I was waiting for the part. I'm like, where's the data guys to come in and start parsing out some interesting, because it's all the same. Oh, this guy's fast and he's got grit and he's got hustle. And so it's, yeah, it's just, I don't think that's ever going to go away. That's always going to be the face of it, no matter how many guys are back there, you know, working the dials. So,
yeah, especially with the draft. I mean, I feel like that's where, like, you have the most area to kind of gain an advantage there, or with player development too, to at least like get everybody kind of on the same page, or kind of like pick up habits in players or tendencies in players, like when they're in junior or in their rookie season, be like, how can we improve this, like, to make you a better player, like throughout like your entry level contract. So I think there's definitely a lot of work you could be doing there without like any super complex, without any like super complex like work being done.
Yeah, that's interesting, because especially a lot, and we had talked to somebody who scouts for Bantam in California in one of the episodes earlier this summer. And I mean, it's all scouting at that level. Like, there's no data available on anyone. And it's probably not until, you know, you're a pretty high prospect, or you're in, you know, like a major junior or something like that, before there really is anything that you can look at conclusively, that if you've never seen this player, trying to just get an idea of what they might be like by just statistics on paper.
Yeah, and it's even tougher with scouting, because you're kind of going off somebody's opinion, basically. And even then, a lot of it is just, I don't know, like, sometimes it's only like 5-10 like data points a game, so you don't have a ton to work with. And I don't know, it's interesting how they can kind of combine the two, especially with the draft, because I feel like that's where that's like the biggest area where you can get the biggest advantage, especially like with the salary cap.
Well, as far as hockey discussion goes, I think that might be enough of the appetizer that we needed, just to kind of to get our brains going, so we can get into the really important conversation we're going to have today here. It's 2003, as first reported here at Second City Hockey. And I think there's been a copious amount, but I've noticed several bands doing 20-year anniversary tours of albums that came out in 2003, many of them being in the punk / emo / whatever world you want to, whatever umbrella of music you want to put it under, but that big genre. And so the idea of the real reason why we have Corey here today, obviously his hockey knowledge is indisputable and great, and we highly recommend everyone go check out his All Three Zones project, because it's some of the stuff we look at all the time to kind of tell us what we're seeing with the Blackhawks, or to confirm that what we're seeing is accurate, or at least what we hope we're seeing. But we want to talk about we're going to take a little trip back in time 20 years ago to 2003. And we're just going to remember some albums. That's all we're going to do here. And this is basically based off the meme of guys will literally sit around and name athletes instead of going to therapy. We're going to sit around and name some albums. And we don't really have any particular order here. We all have lists of albums that came out in 2003, and we're just going to do a little 20-year flashback and talk about how much we loved or hated or whatever with these albums, and just see where it goes. And Corey, with you being the guest, I think it would be rude if we did not let you begin this discussion with the first album you wanted to talk about. So the floor is yours, and then Eric will have you up on deck once Corey's suggestion goes through.
Cool.
All right. So I wasn't sure if we were doing like this from 1 to 10 as far as like what your top album is.
Well, so if you would like to, you certainly you can. This is a blank canvas. We're totally just going however you want to do this. And if you want to start with your one on a list of 1 to 10, please do so.
Yeah, this is probably this is a top five album for me. And since it's a Chicago podcast, I wanted to start with Good Morning by Alkaline Trio.
Okay.
So this was like my favorite album of all time, like from in my early 20s, I want to say. It just had a lot of things that kept you going back to it. The hooks were really good. I felt like the lyrics were always kind of fun, goofy, just kind of fun to sing along to. And I don't know. I was like the biggest Alkaline Trio apologist in the world. Like when I was when I was in my early 20s or a teenager, like I didn't listen to them a lot. Like when I was in middle school, just cause I didn't really know about them until I was older, mm-hmm. but I just kind of sunk my teeth into almost everything they did up until 2013 or something. Then it just kind of became, okay, I got enough Alkaline Trio albums. I don't really need any more. Cause you got like 10 already. But Good Morning's the one I go back to the most, just because the songs in this one are the best. I feel like it's got the best balance of great Matt songs and great Dan songs. Because mm-hmm. like in the early days, I feel like Matt carried the band. And then later, I feel like Dan has the better songs. But this one, I feel like it's an equal mix of both. So, yeah.
I would say I was also a later arrival to the Alkaline Trio bandwagon, if you will. And I think that the point you made about like by 2013, like you think you'd had enough Alkaline Trio albums. And I don't want to say every song sounds the same, because I feel like people say that about every band ever. But I feel like Alkaline Trio's music discography did not take. They didn't do any hard left or right turns musically. I feel like they had a lane. They pretty much stuck to it for most of their careers and didn't stray too far from it, like some other bands we may discuss during this conversation did. And there's nothing wrong with that, because it's good. I like their stuff. I like this album in particular.
Yeah, and it's like if they went slightly left or slightly right as far as their direction goes, you have people freaking out that like... They have a song that kind of sounds like, I don't know, Pat Benatar or something. But I don't know. I feel like that's why I listened to them a lot when I was younger, because they were consistent. You knew what you were going to get going in pretty mm-hmm. much every time. And it's like not going to be the greatest thing you hear, but it's going to be pretty good. But as far as like their overall sound goes, this is probably where I think they sound the best. At least as far as real albums go, they have a ton of B-sides that I feel like are pretty much all of their best songs, to be honest. they're okay. A weird band like that. Like almost all their best songs are B-sides. But like Good Morning, I feel like, is where they sound the best. I don't know if it's like the production or something, or like just they kind of hit their stride as far as like songwriting goes. But like everything they were doing on this record just seemed to hit. It's like they do a slower song, it's good. They do an acoustic song, it's really good. They have a few really fast jams on this song. They have a few really fast jams on this record that are really good. Like We've Had Enough and If We Ever Go Inside. Mm-hmm. They do a love song, Every Thug Needs a Lady. It's really good. They have a song that all like dark punk kids can play at their weddings. So like this is where you get basically everything from them. And you get it, that's at least like a 9 out of 10.
I'll say, I think a lot of it has to do with Derek Grant. And to me, that's kind of like the three different eras of Alkaline Trios. The opening era is Glenn, is their first drummer. And I'm a drummer and I'm a big drum guy, so I'll work out about that stuff.
Please do. But,
Glenn was their first drummer, and it was Matt and Glenn first. And I forget their first bass player's name before Dan came on board. And I think that's why it's so heavily skewed towards Matt songs at the beginning. Is because he wrote all the songs because Dan wasn't in the band yet. And then, but that's their first 7-inch, which is like Snake Oil Tanker, and I forget the other one. And then God Damn It, and then Maybe I'll Catch Fire. And then Mike Flumley was, I can't remember the name of the record before Good Morning. From Here to Infirmary. And that's their goofiest record, I think. To me, and that's the one I probably listened to the least of all their earlier stuff. And then Derek Grant is a beast, man. He is an incredible drummer, and he also is a songwriter too. I don't know if he had anything to do with like writing the songs, but coming in and what's the record after Good Morning?
Crimson.
I love Crimson too. I think Crimson is a great record. Yes. And to me, like those two, they're really locked in on those two albums. And I think a lot of that has to do with Derek too. And he's like a phenomenal drummer. And I know he left the band, I think, earlier this summer.
Yes, he did.
But yeah, I would say, you know, him coming in kind of like gave them that extra little push. And just the way that he plays too, like I think that kind of solidified everything and solidified their sound, at least as far as I'm concerned.
What I've noticed with like with Alkaline Trio especially, and a lot of bands, or not a lot of bands, but a good chunk of bands that I'm into, they started as punk bands and they started to get more like kind of, they started to wear like their 80s influences on their sleeves a little more. And I feel like Alkaline Trio sort of did that around Crimson, and maybe with Agony and Irony too. Do you think like Derek had anything to do with that? Like as far as how to channel that and like turn it into something good?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, he came from the Suicide Machines, which was like a ska punk band.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And he also played in this band, Thoughts of Ionesco, which was like this hardcore band back in the day. I think is just them getting older and kind of like being bored with playing the same stuff, especially Alkaline Trio. Yeah. Their earlier stuff, he's like the dark lord of punk rock, and you know, everything's razor blades and you know, bats, and it's so very, I think
it's I very just, like I'm it's very I'm fucked up and I want to sing about it type of music.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think at a certain point, like you're rich, like you got money, you don't have the same problems anymore. Yeah. So you're not going to write the same, you know, fuck you officer songs that you write when you're 20 years old or whatever. So, but I think Derek could have a lot to do with that too. Just because he's a musician's musician. And I think he probably maybe pushed him a little bit more, as opposed to like Fulumley came in and was just like happy to play drums in the band. So.
All right, Eric, yeah. let's keep it moving along to whatever, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be the top of your list, but the first one you're going to throw out for the class.
So I'll throw out, I've been listening to them for a long time, but I think that the Blink 182 self-titled record, that might be my favorite overall record of theirs. And that's another one, talking about kind of going from just writing punk songs to like expanding and doing some more stuff. I mean, it's a pretty drastic change from the record before. Maybe not so much if you liked the Boxcar Racer record at all, which I really like that a lot too. You can see kind of some more influences, but like Robert Smith is on this record and they do a lot more stuff with like dynamics and like tempo stuff. And you know, there's piano, there's some different things that no one had ever really heard from Blink 182 much before. Mm-hmm. And especially starting off with, I'm totally blanking, the Feeling This song. Is it just called Feeling This?
It's just called Feeling This.
Yeah. Starting off with that kind of as the first signal, like that was a little different itself, but the rest of the record around it is so good. And I think that's some of the best songs they've ever written. And like, even as far as like the singles and the popular stuff goes, like Miss You is kind of a, you know, slower ballady song. That song's really good. Always is like a fantastic pop rock song. And then you have like a couple like more angry kind of, I don't want to say like hardcore, but heavier for them type of songs that are on that record. But I listened to that record like so much when it came out. I was really surprised, but like pleasantly surprised, because that was another one. Like I'd gotten a little bit tired of like the fart jokes and like the shtick and take off your pants and jacket and all that stuff. I always liked that band, like in the same way that I like Screeching Weasel or bands like that, where it's like one type of thing over and over. So to see them like kind of switch it up and expand and do a little bit more stuff, like that made me interested in the band again in a way that I kind of hadn't been in a long time. So that's one of my favorite records that came out that year for sure.
Yeah. I always liked Blink when I was a kid, but I wasn't like a super fan. But I definitely remember, I definitely liked the songs that were singles on this record a lot. Mm-hmm. Like I listened to, I think Always is my favorite Blink song, like overall. That's just because I'm not a huge fan. I just really like, I don't know. I always liked Blink when they kind of did songs like that that weren't like the fast punk songs. It was more just like, I don't know, slow kind of pop rock, I guess.
Yeah.
Just they're really good at writing those.
Yeah. And I think like to Eric's point, like I think this is going to happen with a few other bands we talk about, is that I feel like this was in the era where like this type of music had been popular for a while. Like it was like later 90s when Blink 182 got really big and they'd had a few records under their belt. And so they were not just doing the dick jokes anymore. They were trying to be a little more musically adventurous. So I think that is reflected in this album, and just as a vivid memory of childhood, and this would have been like going into my at some point in high school, but just playing Madden 2004 with Blink-182's Feeling This on the soundtrack and playing the Madden 2004 mini games with that song over and over on it. That is a vivid memory of my childhood. That is forever associated with that game and this band and that particular song off this album.
Yeah, I remember it was called Action on Madden. Yes. And they edited the song because there's something about taking off a woman's clothes or something.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a heavily edited version of the song, but it was the music behind the lyrics was unchanged, so it was pretty good.
That's right. It was like the get ready for action.
Yes, exactly.
I forgot about that. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I could look this up, but it was I'm trying to remember if what time of year that album came out, because obviously the football video game would have been in August, most likely.
I think it was early summer, I feel like. And then, yeah, so then that would have been right. They would have had it in time for Madden, and then kind of into the fall is when it blew up.
Yeah, so maybe it hadn't even been released as a single. And then I think, like, I don't know what, like, the enduring legacy is of Blink-182 overall as a band, but I feel like the second verse of I Miss You is, I mean, I feel like that is indicative of, that is one of the more iconic just verses of that entire thing. Like, I remember, I think you ask any kid between not kid now, we're all adults, but anyone between the ages of like 30 and 50, they probably know that verse if they're anywhere near this particular genre of music on their interests.
I do like that Blink is objectively not an emo band, but they have a song that kind of associates with the era, and they even did like a video that fits in with it too.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Are you talking about the Miss You video?
Yeah.
I was like, what is this, an Alkaline Trio video? Like, there's the spiders and the cobwebs and the skull, especially for like a band that like all their videos were pretty much ridiculous.
They were before
that point.
They made like at least two music videos just mocking boy bands was their whole point, I think.
Kind of wonder if that's what they were doing with this. It was 2003, so you never know.
That's true.
All right, well, I guess it's my turn, and I'm going to start with an album that I might have stolen this off of Corey's list based on our conversation last time. It's Page Avenue by Story of the Year, which was one of the first albums for me that I was able to listen to start to finish. It was one of the first, like, as I was getting deeper into music, this is like an album I could put on and like I liked so many of the songs. It wasn't one I put in my CD, I pulled two or three of those singles that I liked and then put it away and never listened to the other songs ever again. This is one I was listening to all the way through all the time. And I still think to this day, probably their most successful album and their first one, which is usually not how this works for most bands. But they just had this first album and everything just, the right type of music at the right time for them. And they exploded onto the scene. And I don't know if they've ever really been as big or as popular as they were when this album came out. The only bad thing about them is they're all big St. Louis fans. Other than that, everything else is great, and I have nothing bad to say about them.
Yeah, this was one of the first records I remember buying with my own money. And I remember I was going on a road trip to South Carolina, which is like, it was like an 8-hour drive from where I lived at the time. And I listened to this like three or four times on the trip down there, and then a bunch of times while I was in South Carolina. I had the whole thing memorized back then. It was I don't know. They just had a really good sound for like if you're just a kid looking to get into like heavier music.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of most of the songs stuck with me. I don't remember like a lot of the B side of the record, but like the first like five songs though, like I still go back to fairly often. I actually like, I think they sound better live than they do on the record. Because, like, I remember hearing a few songs live, like, on YouTube clips, and I was like, holy crap, this band is really good at playing these old songs. A lot of bands from that era do not, like, their voices don't hold up as well, but, like, Dan can still belt it out better than most.
And it starts off, like, it's such a sonic journey. Just, like, some of the songs, like, there's heavier songs, there's lighter songs, there's, like, Sidewalks is mostly an acoustic, slower song. It's just... It feels like it's they explored a lot of space under the umbrella, and I forget, was it Dan Feldman, the producer?
John Feldman,
there it is. And they, like, he was famous for making all these incredible albums with all these bands during this time, and he walked into the room with these guys and just and helped them produce this incredible album, and that's still, like, they just announced Sword of the Year's gonna tour, and I imagine it's 20 years of Page Avenue. I think they're gonna play the album start to front during the tour, and I'm sure it's still gonna sound just as great today as it did 20 years ago.
I don't know if either of you listen to Krista Makes a Podcast.
I love that show.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was never big. Until the Day We Die. Mm-hmm. That's the big song that I knew from that. But I listened to the Krista Makes episode, and the lead singer, you said his name is Dan?
Yeah, Dan Marcella.
Yeah, and he was awesome. He was really funny. So I was kind of like, okay, afterwards. And sometimes I'll listen to a Krista Makes, and if I don't really know the band or I'm not familiar with them, but they're still going, I'll kind of pull it up and be like, okay, what are they doing now? Like, they definitely still sounded good. And they also, I saw this thing, they did one of the big emo cruises or whatever. But they did like this medley of all these other like bigger, like Taking Back Sunday and all these songs.
Yeah.
So like the crowd. So, I mean, just the fact like they're leaning into it, they're like, it just seems like they're so stoked, like that they still get to be out there playing these songs and people are showing up and they're excited to see them. And like, I really appreciate that.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of people who take themselves way too seriously, especially involved in music. So for them to just be like, this is awesome that we still get to do this, and like, this is so much fun, let's all have fun. Like, I really appreciate that. I thought that was so cool.
I also like they put out a new record this year, and I wouldn't say it's like a throwback album, but it sounds pretty close to how they did around this, and like just perfect timing with like the 20 years coming up with this album and like all the anniversary tours, and they got some awesome new songs to play along with it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think the last time I saw them would have been 4 or 5 years ago, roughly. And I think the energy that you talked about, Eric, on that podcast, like, I think it still comes through in their music. Like, these dudes, like, they're all at least in their 40s. Maybe even some of them have crossed into their 50s. And they're still running around the stage like psychos doing. I'm maybe not backflipping off speakers anymore, but, like, they're still, like, the energy you get just from them on stage makes it impossible you can't not get into the show. It's just, there's too much going on for you to just stand there completely stoned the whole time. You got to get into it because the band's giving off so much energy, and it makes for a fun show. I'm excited to see them when they roll through the area next. So with that being said, I think we throw it back over to Corey for the second time through the lineup here.
All right. So I'm going to go with my favorite record of all time, AFI Sing the Sorrow.
Okay.
And, this is kind of where it all started for me, what just got me hooked on like this side of music. Opened the door for me to finding a lot of other bands. I joined their online fan club, the Despair Faction, that also I made a lot of friends through that, went to a lot of shows through that, found out about a lot of bands through that too, just because, like, I don't know, they caught like a wide variety of people around this time, and they're all into different things. Like, there were some kids into the more heavier stuff. Some kids were into more hardcore stuff. Some kids were just into more mainstream stuff. And you just caught like a wide net of people just into some kind of form of alternative music. And for like the album itself, a lot of it, like, I mean, Girls Not Grey drew me in like at first, and the leading song Part Two, obviously, but like, I don't know, the aesthetic drew me in. They had a lot of great hooks on this record, and like every time I listen to it, I just kind of find something else to like about it. And a few years later, like, I started playing guitar, and a lot of the songs on there, it's like they're not super hard to play, but like Jay does something different, like throughout like all the verses, and it's all like based on one chord. Like, he's not just strumming bar chords, he's kind of just playing individual notes and changing like one or two things here and there to kind of make the song more interesting. And that was just kind of cool to learn that, like, you don't need to be a shredder to be like a good guitar player and like guitar playing. Like, I was also a metal kid, and like, I don't know, it just kind of taught me that, like, you don't need to be like this guitar virtuoso to be a good guitar player, because I think some kids kind of get caught up in that with, like, trying to play as fast as possible. But yeah, like, this kind of started my whole just music journey, and I always keep going back to it for that reason.
I couldn't claim that this was like an album I obsessed with and listened to all the time, but I will say Leaving Song Part 2 is a song I was obsessed with and listened to all the time. And just the way that song, like, when they're coming out of the first chorus and they're going into the second verse, and the way that second verse just kind of builds up to the next chorus, that, like, 20 to 30 seconds is some of my favorite music. Just that little part, it might be my favorite of everything AFI has ever done, just because the way it builds, I have a hard time describing it to anyone else, but just it sounds so good to me. And there's just, like, there's all this build up to the next chorus, and, like, you feel it, like, within, you just feel it as you're listening. You just get really excited for the chorus that's coming, because just the way all the music and the vocals and the lyrics and everything is building up, and they even threw some Spanish lyrics in there just for fun.
Yeah.
I like that particular song. That's one of my favorite singles from all this entire era for sure.
Yeah. They do that well on the whole record, like on Dancing Through Sunday is a shorter song, but they build up the chorus really well in that song. And it kind of, like, it ends in this, like, one of the only guitar solos on the record. And it's kind of like a nice bonus thrown in there. Then there's a song, like Death of Seasons. Like, that song is so intense and, like, so angry when you first listen to it. And it's, like, kind of almost too much, like, on your first listen. But, like, you go back to it and you kind of realize how complex the song is, because there's, like, so many different elements they throw in there. Because, like, it's part a hardcore song, then it kind of goes into, like, this rocky, catchy chorus with a lot of hooks. And then, like, it ends like almost like, I don't know, it ends just with, like, Davey's screaming with no music in the background, just like a loop. And looking back, I'm kind of like, wow, they really did a lot here for just, like, a punk band that song in particular.
Go ahead, Corey, sorry.
Yeah, but, like, I don't know, it just kind of, that's what I mean by, like, I always find something different to like about almost every song when I go back to it. But that could be just me, like, having listened to this record, like, dozens of times a year since I was 13.
I'd be me remiss if I don't at least acknowledge at some point the connection between CM Punk and Miseria Cantare and the opening song off of the album, just because we have plenty of wrestling tangents on this podcast. So I had to squeeze that in before I let Eric offer his thoughts on the album. I wasn't even aware of it until Punk came out at the pay-per-view in the white shorts and the AFI. I'm like, and apparently that was his whole thing back in his Ring of Honor days. I had no idea, but I learned something new.
Yeah, as a side tangent here, so AFI, they were big on opening tracks for a while, and they have one called Strength Through Wounding on Black Sails in the Sunset, and it has like a rally cry on it that their fans love, and they started playing that again on these on their most recent tours. But, like, Miseria Cantare is the better song, and why they don't open every show with that is beyond me.
Because they don't want to give people the impression that CM Punk is about to enter.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right. Sorry, Eric. I felt like you were about to talk and I cut you off. Go right ahead.
No worries. No, it's weird because my perspective, and this is where I show my age a little bit, is kind of, I see it from the opposite. I saw AFI at the Fireside when they were, like, babies. And they, in their, like, East Bay hardcore, like, they all used to wear suits like they were the Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, and answer that.
So then they kind of went off my radar a little bit, especially as I kind of stopped listening to that style of music, or kind of grew up a little bit more. And then it was like all of a sudden this record and Girls Not Great, like, they were back and they're on MTV and they're everywhere. And it's, for me, it was kind of like the reverse effect of, like, when Metallica all cut all their hair off and everybody was like, what the fuck? To see them from, like, all these hardcore dudes with, like, shaved heads and, like, wearing these shitty suits and everything's East Bay Hardcore. And then Davey's got, like, super long hair and he's black. And I was just kind of like, this is the same band. Like, it took me a minute, but they were able to kind of marry all these different styles and influences. And that's kind of, I, you know, Corey was hitting on that a little bit. Like, there's a little bit of every, there's certain bands that everybody can kind of like get behind and that unify everybody. And AFI really seemed to be one of those bands where it was punk kids and emo kids and metal kids and hardcore kids. And they kind of had all these influences. They put everything together and they were one of the biggest, whether you want to call them punk or emo or whatever they were. I mean, didn't they won an MTV award?
They
if
did.
I remember correctly.
Two of them.
Yeah. They were like this huge, gigantic band for a while. And I used to work here. I worked at the Metro for a little bit and they had a listening party for what's the record with the rabbits on it?
December Underground.
And it was sold out and it was the band was not there. It was kids showing up just to hear the record before it came out. And this was in the era of where pirating was everywhere. So the record was no doubt already out, but it was 1,000 kids showed up just to listen to this record in a room together. And that was it. So, yeah. I mean, that's pretty insane, especially for a band that was like the opening band at the Fireside Bowl when I saw them to get to that level. And I think that they were one of the first bands kind of that ilk to really get that popular that fast. But I mean, it's well-deserved. They wrote some great songs and, you know, you can see like they still have a huge influence on a lot of bands now.
Yeah.
I feel like this entire conversation is going to show our age. I'm glad I did a rear survey of our demographic so I know that we don't have to go back and explain some of these concepts to the people who are listening to this, because otherwise we might.
We still might. We don't know if anybody cares about this stuff.
Kids ask your parents.
Yeah, like 2003-ish, like 2003-2006-ish, that was like the peak of AFI's popularity, and their fans were mad dedicated / a little crazy. Like, I couldn't believe they were still playing like clubs and stuff just because of how quickly those shows would sell out, at least where I live.
So I think we are on Eric. I believe it's your turn now, or did I do that wrong?
No. Yeah, Corey just went today.
Okay, there we go. Go right ahead.
I'm going to talk quickly about a record. I don't know if either of you have ever heard it, but it is, and I didn't hear it till a couple years later. So it's by a band called Envy, and they're a band. They're actually from Japan. Okay. They're kind of an emo, but in the older sense of the word, more like the Sunny Day Real Estate Rites of Spring kind of sense, I guess you could say a little bit of that, but they're really heavy. And it's kind of that borderline, like between, you know, beautiful music and like ethereal singing to incredibly loud and incredibly screaming. But they would come and play in America every couple of years. And I got to see them at Beat Kitchen once. And they were just, it was one of those shows that like, that's why you go to shows. You know, yeah. you get lucky and you kind of catch this moment and you stand there like a doofus with your mouth open, like, oh my God. And so, yeah, the record's called A Dead Sinking Story. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal record. They're still around, kind of kicking, doing some stuff every once in a while. But yeah, that was one of my favorite records of 2003 too.
I know Envy, but I haven't listened to them much aside from that split they did with Thursday.
Yeah, and yeah, that's right.
Yeah, like that type of music I can only really do in like small doses. But every time they're one of those bands where like whenever I hear them, I'm like, you know, I should listen to this band more. They're pretty cool. But like sometimes like I can only do it for like an album or two, especially like now that I'm oldish and don't listen to music for like 12 hours out of my day.
But yeah, it's like eating the same thing over and over again. Like there's not a lot of their songs. It's obvious that it's an Envy song and it's kind of the same type of song over and over and over again. So if you're in the mood for it, it's incredible, but it's not something I think that, yeah, anybody could like put on every single day and be like, yes.
From what I remember, they kind of sound like they always kind of sounded like a rainstorm. Just like with the guitars and like the vocals, I can't understand.
I want to listen to this album because I'm not going to claim to have any knowledge of it, but I now want to listen to it off that description alone.
That's a great description. That's a great way to put it. And it is kind of like that. It's a little soft at first, and then eventually it comes on and it goes pretty hard.
Do they ever have a song on any of the soundtracks for any of the Crow movies? Because I feel like that movie is a rainstorm, so I feel like that's kind of where they belong.
I don't believe that they did, but that is, if we want to talk great soundtrack records one day, then that one can definitely be on there. That's it.
Yeah, that'll be our episode. We'll start making these our summer series, our summer music talk. Second City Music. We'll have a whole new website just dedicated to it.
There you go.
What was the name of the album, by the way? Yeah, I heard the band, but I don't know if you said the album.
A Dead Sinking Story.
Yeah, based off the description, that sounds about right. All right, well, I guess that means it's my turn, and I was going to start here, but I wanted to go somewhere else initially, but now we just have to come back home to the band, I assume, and the album everyone would have expected me to start with, and that's The Artist in the Ambulance by Thrice, which is like top two or three for me, still favorite personal albums of my entire life. They're touring. They played the album start to finish a couple months ago. They're coming back to Chicago in October, and I had so much fun. I'm going to go see it again for the second time in the year. They also re-recorded the album in with a more updated version of it, because the band was all in their early 20s when they recorded it in 03, and now they're all in their 40s and have different musical stylings. And I feel like each version of the album is excellent in its own way. I think this album was kind of the beginning of the transition for Thrice from when they were just kind of a young, like really like intense punk band with a lot of really heavy guitars and solos and screaming lyrics. And then this was kind of the beginning that they were starting to move away from that. And then after this, they had Visu and then a full on, the four part album, a themed album. A project album. I don't know what the hell the word is I'm looking for. Concept album. Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, the four part series. Yes. Yeah,
the Alchemy Index. So, there's so much on this album. Like there are, there's incredibly. It starts off heavy. There's lighter songs in the middle. It goes back to heavy. It goes like I feel like this is another thing where sometimes I feel like I don't really have the words to describe why this album sounds so good to me. I just know that when I listen to it, it is 45 to 50 minutes of just bliss every time, because it strikes every musical chord within me that I appreciate.
Yeah, I feel like this is one of those records that it feels like it lasts only 5 minutes to me whenever I listen to it. Like, because that's just how much I enjoy all the songs. I also feel like if Silhouette doesn't punk you up, then something's wrong with you.
Yeah. And an album I forget how it was described, but the band, like, someone on a podcast, someone from the band said they all love playing that song. There's something about it that strikes their interests as a band. It hits all, like, they all love the way it sounds or plays or whatever. And so I feel like I've heard Silhouette at every single Thrice show I've ever attended, and none of that is a complaint. It's more of just when I hear like the opening riff, I'm like, I need to decide how much energy I have that particular day and whether or not I'm going to get crushed in a pit somewhere.
Yeah, like I've only seen them once, but I think they played that second when I saw them. So I was like, all right, we're going to get everybody working early here.
No, I feel like that is where it's usually the first song they play on a tour is the first song off the album that they're touring because of, and then they go into Silhouette to make sure everyone's ready to roll.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great crowd pleaser, but yeah, Thrice is one of my favorite bands too. Like I've enjoyed pretty much everything they've done. I think Visu is my favorite record though. Like this Artist is really close. It was my favorite for a while, but Visu, I just listen to it a lot more. And I don't know. I listened to the Alchemy Index a lot more as I got older too, especially the Fire Disc. Like that was that was one I didn't really care for when it came out and for the longest time. But like the last like few years or so, I keep going back to those songs, like The Messenger especially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. It just feels like they can play almost any style of almost any style of music, and it's going to be pretty good.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that has always made me such a huge fan of Thrice forever is, like, Eric, to the thing you said earlier about how you're a drummer, so you get on board, you can be nerd out on some drumming. As someone who does a decent amount of writing for a living, I love a well-written song lyrically, and I feel like Thrice's lyrics are always, it's never some dumb cliche shit. It's always well-written, well-thought-out things, and there's usually some sort of message within every song. Typically, it's not just like a bunch of words on a piece of paper that match up with the melody of the song. There's something that is being communicated in every single song. And some of them are, sometimes it's a social commentary. Sometimes it's just about life itself. Sometimes it's about specific things that have happened in the past or are ongoing in the world today. And I feel like as I'm looking at the songs, like I can tell you, I have an idea of what each song, like, the kind of the theme of each lyrical journey is within each song. And there's something about that really resonates with me. That's part of the reason why I adore this band so much.
Well, and I'm kind of an outsider with Thrice too, in that I knew, some of their bigger songs and I knew of them as a band, but I never really dove into them too much. But that was one thing that always struck me. That's what you said, is there's a thoughtfulness to them. Everything is very intentional, everything that they do. And it's on a different level than probably some of the other records that, we talk about, or some of the other records that came out this year. Just even like the word, the artist in the ambulance, art to me implies like there's a certain level of, thoughtfulness that you put into something, or a certain level of like effort. I'm fumbling for the word that I'm trying to find, but just that Thrice is more of like, there's more thought into it. It's more of a thinking man's band. Like there's a lot more. And I mean, you're talking about concept records, you're talking about other things that they're involved in that a lot of bands kind of that came up in the scene at the same time of them had no interest in doing, or, had no interest in exploring. So that was one thing that I always kind of appreciated about them, kind of, from afar, standing back a little bit.
So I have a story about Thrice that happened to me late last year. And I'm going to do this to ask a question to each of you related to music music and bands in general. So I was at Thrice played at Furnace Fest in Birmingham last year. The next day we were at the Birmingham airport, me and friend of the show, Jimmy, and we were sitting at a diner and Alexis on Fire's band walked in and was sitting on the other side of this little wall, like mini divider, to where we knew they were there, but we couldn't look directly at them because of the wall. And as we're sitting there eating our breakfast, my buddy Jimmy goes, like, he glanced in that direction up over and goes, "Oh, hey, like Thrice is over there. Like the whole band is around the corner." And sure enough, like 5 seconds later, the whole band came around the corner and I completely froze up. Like I didn't know what to say, what to do. And I feel like that hasn't happened to me in a very long time. Like, I don't think I get that around athletes as much anymore. Mainly because they're all younger than me, but my favorite band of my life is 5 feet from me, and I could not say a word because I just didn't know what to say because everything went to my head all at once, like a total fanboy moment, if you will. Does that happen to either one of you still, or have you had any interactions with bands since you turned at least, I'd say, 30 or maybe even 25 or whatever? Does that still happen to you with musicians? Because I feel like there's a different thing with musicians than there is with athletes if you meet them in the wild.
Early 20s, yeah, a little bit, but since I turned like 25, I'm not sure. I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. I remember going to like Warped Tour in 2016, and like bands are always kind of walking around just roaming there.
Yeah, yeah.
And like you kind of just shoot the shit with them for like 2 minutes or so. Like Andy from Every Time I Die does that with almost everybody, which is always cool with him. But I'm trying to think like if I've met anybody since then. I'm not entirely sure. I remember once, like, I think I was like 23 or something, but like I met Jason from Let Live, who is now the singer of the Fever 333.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And like that was right after The Black Is Beautiful came out, and like that was a really important record for me at the time. That was like, I met him after a show and I was like, I don't know. All I was really doing then was just listening to music and going to work. So I kind of had a fanboy moment then, but I think that's the last time it happened.
Yeah. I couldn't decide if I was like embarrassed that it happened to me or like I was kind of like happy that like, oh, this is still a thing for me. Like that it's still something that there was something comforting about the fact that I could still have that happen to me, that like, I still like there's things I can still look up to with such high esteem that I could have that reaction. Eric, about any similar stories for you?
Well, I think you have like this huge emotional connection, especially to music. And like, mm-hmm. we've all, this record is really important to me. This record helped mm-hmm. me get through this. Like, there's no way you can adequately sum that up. But at the same time, like, those guys get it more than anybody else because like, they love music. So that's why they do it. So I think it's impossible to like adequately express what something like that means to you to somebody in the matter of a few seconds.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I think that those dudes get it. And I mean, I grew up, like I said, you know, going to the Fireside. It used to be when you go to the Fireside, there was one place to eat. There was a KFC on Fullerton across the street from it. So that you'd see every band would be in there because that was the only place to eat around there. So if we took the train in and we got down there a little early, you'd go and you'd sit and you'd be like, oh, there's fucking Fat Mike, or, you know, there's whatever dude from this band. And because there's nowhere else to go. And that was the beautiful thing about it back then is like, these guys are loading their stuff in right in front of you. You're standing there, you're standing next to them in the bathroom, you're standing next to them in line to buy a t-shirt, whatever. So it kind of, you don't feel like anybody's, you know, this big, huge person. They're accessible. You can talk to them about whatever. And you'd always like talk to the bands and ask them stuff and, you know, get stickers. And that's different than a lot of, you know, when these bands became like these big, huge, gigantic bands. I saw Dallas Green from Alexis on Fire. I went with my wife. He was like playing in a casino for like 5,000 people. It was horrible. It was a terrible show. We're so far back. And I'm like, I've stood in front of this dude and like he sweated on me before. Like I can't ever get past that stuff. So to me, those guys, especially like Thrice, like Alexis on Fire, those, they used to play at rec centers in front of kids. Like there's a part of them that are always going to be that guy. So I don't think you should ever like sweat it. And I think they get it. If you're like, hey man, like this record means a lot to me. They know exactly what you mean because like, that's the thing that unifies. That's the three of us can sit here and talk about this stuff because we all get it. Cause we kind of, we came through the same way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I got to there was like a point where if I met like a band or anybody, I like kind of tried not to be the Punisher, if you know what I mean. Like try to talk to, like I would just say, hey, great job tonight.
just good show. Great show. That's usually a nice, easy way to break the ice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I'd met other bands that I'd really liked and like it had other instances where the last time I saw Story of the Year, Dan hung around and shook hands and took photos and I talked to him for a minute or two and like that was cool, but something about seeing that particular band, I was just like, what do I say?
Yeah, I do remember like this one show we went to I went to with one of my friends in Maryland, and like I feel like we hung out like with the bands that played. I think it was Hit the Lights and Seaway, like two pop punk bands, but they were just chilling around at the venue until like it closed basically. That was like, I think that was like the time where I was like, oh, they are just like regular dudes or whatever.
Yeah. I think that's like you sometimes, I think we forget this with athletes too. Like they're just people. So they might have really cool jobs and be really, really good at those jobs. But at the end of the day, they are just other human beings, just kind of like you. But sometimes it's hard to realize that in the moment. All right. We got one more. I think we can do one more time through the lineup here. Maybe we'll do some honorable mentions at the end, but Corey, if you want to get us started on this last trip through, and we'll start to put a bow on all this conversation here.
All right, so I'm gonna do Thursday War All the Time.
Yes,
probably the record I probably like next to Sing the Sorrow and Good Morning, the record I listened to the most from 2003. It's probably like I would say it's my favorite album out of that whole just post hardcore wave that was going on back then. That was a few years late to it. Because like with Thursday, I never really listened to them. They didn't have any songs on the radio. They didn't have a lot of music videos on MTV. So like it took me a while to really hear them. if that makes any sense. But yeah, like once I got this record, I was just hooked on it. And like they actually just released a they released a live album of this. I don't remember when they were touring it, but they played the whole record in full and it's on Spotify now. And Jeff was saying, like, Before Tomorrow I'll Be You, that like he was talking about how music is kind of just like, it's like hanging out with a friend if you've had like a shitty day or something. It's like, it doesn't fix anything. It doesn't like make your situation better, but like for an hour or however long it is, like you feel just a little better and like you can get on with your day. And that's kind of what, that's what War All the Time was for me. Like when I was in high school and like early in college, when I was just hooked on this record all the time. Just because really good lyrics, great hooks, really good. Just kind of, I don't know. The sequencing on the record's really good too. Like they give you a breather with "The Song Is Brought to You by a Falling Bomb," and then kind of just tear into "Steps Ascend." And I don't know. I just love this record.
I really like that sentiment from, it's Jeff Raleigh, I believe, is the lead singer's first and last name.
Rickley.
Rickley. Close. Yeah. Jeff Raleigh's a skateboarder from Tony Hawk. From one of the Tony Hawk games, I think.
Dave, I would have made the exact same mistake, and you are absolutely right.
Oh, wow. That was a good one. But yeah, but anyway, I love that sentiment from him. I think that's a very good way to put it, that sometimes a spin through a record is the perfect antidote for at the end of a shitty day for an hour or so. And Thursday's, like, I feel like I completely missed the boat on Thursday, because I think there was a heavy overlap. Like, I feel like you were either a Thrice fan or a Thursday fan, and like you went really, really deep into one of those bands. And I feel like there was so much overlap between the two of them that it seemed like you were one or the other, and I was in the Thrice camp. And then I eventually found my way back through Thursday's music, and it's really good. Like there's so much good stuff. Like this album's great. I don't have anything bad to say about it. Like they still play. If you go see them live, and like they've been touring a decent amount, and they still usually grab a few songs off this record to play, and they still sound great live. Like I think I missed that tour where they played War All the Time start to finish, because that'd be fun. I'd absolutely pay money to go see that. But yeah, it's great. I don't have anything bad to say about it.
It's funny because like Thursday and Thrice, they get compared all the time.
Yeah,
and like they've brought it up before, and they're like, you know, we've never actually toured together. We're from different. It's like we're from New Jersey. Thrice is from California.
Yeah, yeah.
But we always get compared. It's like we always get compared for some reason. And like I guess I can kind of hear it, like when both of these records, maybe a little, but they're definitely two very different bands. But they do kind of build like a, they do build like a sonic landscape that's kind of similar. Like Thursday lyrics are a little more, I don't know, a little more like social commentary sometimes. Right. They kind of drift into that, but it's very personal too, especially Tomorrow I'll Be You. Like that song in particular is like always really resonated with, like really resonated with me. Just somebody that was like struggling to really just like themselves, if that makes any sense, and kind of like figure out who they are like as a young adult. So that's what this record's always kind of, it's always hung around with me, even like in my 30s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm just like the two songs that are standing out as I'm looking at the track list in front of me is just how it starts with For the Work First Drowning, which is pretty intense from the get-go. And then get down to the song you referenced, the song brought to you by Falling Bomb, speaking of songs with social commentary in them. And it like, it's not like the album completely stops, but it certainly slows the hell down during that song. So
yeah, and go ahead.
No, keep talking about the record. I was gonna say something stupid, so
but yeah, like I don't know, if there's like a band that kind of sums up that whole style of like post-hardcore, like I don't know, it's like the next, some people consider Full Collapse like what the next step to like At the Drive-In was. Mm-hmm. And like I don't know if that, I wouldn't say it's like a fair comparison, but I kind of get what people are saying. But like that record is a lot more raw. This one is a lot more polished. I feel like the production is a lot better. It's a lot more, I don't know, organized, if that makes any sense. Because Full Collapse is a little, can be a little too much at times, like if you're not like prepared for it. Just like with all the screaming and kind of the songs are a little all over the place. And this one is like perfect. Because like after this record, they started drifting into a lot more like spacey type of music. And that was still cool, but this is like the one that's like, it's like the perfect medium between just heavy and like heavy and like catchiness.
Eric, I don't know if you still had so you want to get some jokes off or want to
talk? Well, my dumb comment was going to be, I guarantee you I think that Thrice and Thursday were probably compared to each other because they were probably shelved right next to each other in every single record store.
There probably is something to do with that. They both start with TH. That's almost certainly part of
THR, THU. Yeah, right? Yeah. I guarantee you right behind each other. Yeah. I'll take a little bit of a left turn here. There's a book by a rock and roll writer named Dan Ozzie, and it's called Sellout.
I'm so upset it took this long to get to that book, but please continue.
But yeah, that's kind of the most that I really know my delve into Thursday is from reading the chapter about this record in Dan Ozzie's book, which is a fantastic book. And it was a really interesting chapter too. And especially there was a lot of stuff going on in kind of in the New Jersey scene that, you know, Thursday was a part of at that time. There's a lot of bands, really cool and interesting bands that came out of that too. I just wanted to put a little plug in for that book for anybody who's still listening at this point, who's into this conversation. If you're not familiar with that book, you should definitely check that book out because it is awesome. It's really cool.
Yeah, there's chapters on, I'm holding the book in my hand. There's a Jawbreaker chapter, Jimmy Rolled Blink at the Drive-In, the Donnas, Thursday, My Chem, Rise Against Me. Like it's such a great book, and there's so many, it really helps kind of paint the picture of how the music evolved and how this band begot this band and so on and so forth. And it also, it's a fascinating book to where they start in the 90s with Green Day, or maybe even earlier than that. I forget what the first chapter of the book is, but it starts before the internet and it ends with Against Me as the internet's starting to take over the world. So there's all these things going on all at the same time in the book. And if you're a fan of this music, you will love that book. Highly recommend as well.
Yeah. And the undercurrents is like this stuff, it became a business, and it was right around the time when like extreme sports and skateboarding, when like people were like, oh, there's a lot of money to be made off this stuff. Yeah. So that's, and I think that's why it's called Sellout. That used to be like this super insulting term, you know, which the whole chapter for Green Day and Jawbreaker is really, that's kind of, I feel like the end of that Sellout era where it was like, you know, the scarlet letter, you know, to be placed on any independent band. But
yeah. And it's funny that like now all the people who grew up listening to that music, that When We Were Young festival was obviously an attempt to cash in on all the nostalgia of all these people who are now adults with full-time jobs. And some of them probably have enough money to spend a lot of money in Vegas for a weekend. And it was a cool thing. I don't want to sound like I'm trashing it. It is a very neat thing, but it was obviously like people doing the math of like, oh, like all these former teenagers are now in their 30s and 40s and probably have money to spend seeing all these bands that they grew up with. And so let's try and capitalize on that.
Yeah, I saw somebody compared to like Disney adults and I felt sort of called out.
That's like a combination of like a laugh and like, oh shit. Yeah, they're probably right, but
they're not wrong. Yeah.
They're not wrong. All right.
At least like,
go ahead.
At least like, as far as like the emo cruise goes, if you've seen that.
Yeah. There's a band that does a cruise that I might, I'm still trying to decide which album I'm going to pick. So I'm going to let Eric go first while I still am kicking a few around in my head.
I think I know where you're going, Dave. So this is one of my all-time favorite records, maybe even top five favorite records, and it's The Greatest Story Ever Told by the Lawrence Arms.
Okay.
To me, this is another one of those records where like the band became the band on this album. They were a little bit more goofy before, and like I had seen, you know, Slapstick back in the day. And Chris's first band was called Tricky Dick, and Tricky Dick still to this day, they are so good. They don't have stuff anywhere but Bandcamp, but I love that band. He's one of my favorite guitar players. And that Tricky Dick record is incredible. It is fantastic. I didn't really like the Broadways, which was their band afterwards. And it's weird because there's kind of this similar, like, so Dan was in Slapstick with Brendan. Then Dan started Tuesday. Brendan started the Broadways. So when Dan kind of went with Alkaline Trio, even though they're all like buddies and they play together all the time, it kind of felt like an either or type of thing. So that's where I kind of started to pull away from Alkaline Trio, was when The Greatest Story Ever Told came out. I wasn't expecting much. I didn't really like kind of the earlier Lawrence Arms stuff. I thought it was, you know, kind of silly and, you know, a little goofy. But this record just like hit me like a ton of bricks. And I still, it's one of those, I can't listen to one song from the record because it feels like taking one bite of a meal. Like I have to listen to the whole thing. So it's start to finish, you know, all the way through lyrically. And they kind of, they do like thematic stuff with their records now where everything kind of weaves together to tell this bigger story. So I guess it's kind of a concept album in a way. And this is kind of the first version of that. So I think that they kind of grew up and it came out and I listened to it at a time in my life where I was kind of growing up and I was ready for like a little bit more from my music and a little bit more like lyrically. And so it was kind of the perfect record at the perfect time. And it's 20 years later. I think it's obviously, it's still one of my favorite records. It's their best record, but it still feels like fresh and new. And I listen to it and I'll pick up on some little thing that I didn't pick up on before, or some, you know, alternate meaning of a lyric, and it'll kind of spin the song in a different way. So I've grown up with it. I continue to grow up with it. And I feel like the record still changes and it's still different things as I listen to it now. And to me, that's like the hallmark of something that's really important to you artistically, is that it stays with you, and it stayed with me all this time.
Yeah, this was a record that I listened to a lot of like my senior year of high school and in college, because like I was really big into Alkaline Trio, and I feel like the Lawrence Arms were like another band I picked up on from just looking at Asian Man catalog and stuff. And this is the record that I probably still listen to the most for them. And it's like you were saying, every song flows together so perfectly, and like you can't just listen to one song because like it feels so incomplete without it. I was really into a lot of like just the Midwestern punk scene like when I was 18 or 19. Like I couldn't get enough of like the Lawrence Arms, Dillinger Four, Dear Landlord, Banner Pilot, all those bands. But like this is the one record that I felt was like every band was trying to make a record as good as this one, and none of them could.
I'm very upset with younger versions of myself that I did not become familiar with Lawrence Arms until like the early 2010s, I think, which I believe is when they took a significant break as a band. And I think around the time, it was like a year or two after I became aware of their existence, was when Metropole came out. And I was like, oh, hey, they're back. Cool. Oh, Calcutta is always my favorite Lawrence Arms record. Like, I think to your thing, Eric, like that's the album where I started. Like, I'm going all the way through. This album cannot be started and stopped in the middle unless I get a 911 phone call. That's about it. The only thing that's going to stop me. But this album is really, really good. I really, really like it. But anytime I hear references to the Lawrence Arms, I'm just mad at like teenage and early 20s me. Like, go find out about Lawrence Arms. Like, just go listen to him now. Don't wait 10 more years, you idiot. So it's mainly regret whenever I hear Lawrence Arms that I didn't know about them earlier. But I'm glad I've at least tried to catch up since then.
Well, I think everybody slept on them until they had kind of like a weird boom. And they got a lot more, they're like one of those rare bands that seems to have gotten a lot more popular and kind of found this other level of fans as they get older. Like they almost broke up a bunch of times because kind of, especially even in Chicago, everyone was kind of indifferent to them a little bit at first. And this record came out and really established them. And I think they kind of grew up and this record reflected that in their songwriting too. And it took a little bit, but that's kind of what saved them as a band or pushed them up to the next level to where they were, they were headlining their own stuff and they weren't like opening for bigger bands all the time.
And I believe they're also famously the only band to get kicked off the Warped Tour because Brendan went during one of the shows. He was trashing the people running the event for charging like $5 for a bottle of water when it was like 120 degrees or something like that.
So not only did they get kicked off the Warped Tour, and this is a testament, I think, to Brendan Kelly's punk rockness. Mike D from the Beastie Boys was there because they were going to get signed to Grand Royal. He was watching them from the side of the stage. Brendan went off and Mike D left before they even played a song because Brendan went off on Warped Tour and then they got banned from Warped Tour and they didn't sign to Grand Royal because of that. But it has, there's a whole, he tells a whole story about it. If you're really interested, go look it up. And I know he did a podcast about it too. It's really interesting. And there's a lot more to it that I can't.
Just with what it does to the touring market during the summer, what it did to the touring market during the summer. Like, I remember not going to Warped Tour for a few years because of that. Because I was like, oh, this is actually pretty, like, shitty.
Yeah, and there's so many other bands on those tours that should have been kicked off for other reasons. Brendan, or Lawrence Arms got kicked off because Brendan said, hey, These people, it's hot as hell. Get these people some water. Yeah. What a time.
What a time.
All right. Well, I think, Eric, you said you might know where I was going here. Were you thinking Coheed and Cambria? Is that where you were?
I was. I know that they do their cruise. And as soon as you said that, and that was on my list too to talk about.
Because that is I think the only thing that would get me on a cruise is if it was a themed cruise, which was something that I really appreciate. And it would have to be music and bands I really, really like that are going to get me to be on a boat on the ocean for several days at a time. Because otherwise the idea of a cruise sounds terrible to me. But Coheed and Cambria and Keeping Secrets of Silent Earth, Volume 3. It's not Volume 3, it's just In Keeping Secrets of Silent Earth 3. This is when this album came out. I probably got Blood Red Summer and Favor House Atlantic and pulled them off. And I was talking about this earlier, like I burned them off the CD, put them into Windows Media Player, and probably didn't listen to the rest of the album for 5 to 10 years because that's how I was when I was a teenager. As I have gotten older, and I feel like my musical appreciation has matured a bit, and I try to do more album listens, although I can't claim I do it all the time. There's still plenty of playlists I have that are just singles. There's so many good songs on this album, and I think the range of it, like having like your Blood Red Summer and Favorite House Atlantic are your classic like emo pop punk or poppier singles, if you will, and then you have In Keeping Secrets of Silent Earth, which is just an 8-minute rock saga. And everything in between with the rest of the album, there's just I think Coheed and Cambria is a band that as I've gotten older, because they just do so much. Their music is very like they stay within the confines of like punk rock or whatever you want to call it, but they also like it doesn't feel like they're constrained by it. They go on, there's incredibly long guitar solos and their shows are incredible. Every time I go see them live, I feel like it's a different show each time because of there's a little bit of improvisation. I feel like they're as close you can get to like, I don't want to say like a punk rock jam band, but just kind of the idea of they're probably not just going to play the song the way it sounds on the record, whatever you see it. There's going to be some improvisation every time you go see them. And I think this album kind of it is indicative of their range as musicians. And then when you go see it and hear it live, it's indicative of the range of their live performances, which also speaks to their prowess with various instruments. So I love this album and this band, and I don't think I fully appreciated it when it first came out 20 years ago, but I feel like I'm getting to a much closer spot to appreciating it the way I should now.
They're definitely the punk rock, prog rock band, that's for sure.
Yes. Yeah, like I feel like they get slapped with they're the modern day Rush, which, you know, I don't know how good or accurate of a comparison that is, but I feel like I've heard that.
Yeah, A Favor House Atlantic, I remember that would come on MTV like every so often on like the rock shows. Yes. And I would like within like 5 seconds I would always change the channel. And like, it took like a few months for me to like warm up to that song and eventually the band. Mm-hmm. And like, this isn't my favorite Coheed record. The next one is Good Apollo 4. Like that yeah. one, I love that record. This one I like especially the title track.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cool because it's like it's a very interesting like complex record, but it doesn't feel like it is when you're listening to it. It's easy to take in and digest. I think it really just depends on how you feel about Claudia's vocals at the beginning, because
that's true.
If you're like me and like you want to listen to a rock record, sometimes that's the last thing you want to hear.
That is a very good point, and I think that might have been part of my apprehension when I was younger, because it is definitely higher pitched vocals than most other bands.
That yeah. is one of my favorite things, is having somebody who's never really listened to them or seen them before be like, what do you think this singer looks like? And then showing them what he looks like. That is like the biggest case of voice body disconnect. Then, and I don't know if anybody's a Cubs fan, but Aramis Ramirez back in the day, you're like, there's no way this person should talk with, it just doesn't fit. Like your brain can't put them together. Watching Claudio with his hair and sometimes his beard and just like singing like this high pitch. It's just, it does not compute.
So props to him for still looking like that at however old he is too. Cause I think he still has the hair and the beard.
How else is he going to look?
You never know. I mean, some bands have to like change the way they look just from not being able to maintain.
That would be, if he lost his hair, that would be very strange. Like it's good. He's got good genes. I mean, as far as I know, I'm guessing he's not out there wearing a wig or anything, but yeah, that would be really weird for him not to have that massive hair.
I'll report back in a month, cause they're coming through and I have tickets. So I will report back on the follicle prowess of one Claudio Sanchez. I'm not worried. I'm pretty sure it's going to be glorious.
Yo, I saw a video of them not too long ago, and yeah, he still looks exactly the same. And I don't know if they still have their bass player. Their old bass player used to look like Rick Moranis. Like he looked so much like Rick Moranis. It was pretty awesome. But and weirdly, yeah, they're one of those bands who kind of had this weird commercial appeal that I don't think anybody was expecting. And like my little sister got into a lot of stuff because of me and my brother, and for her and like all her friends loved Coheed and Cambria. So, which made no sense to me. So I took her for her birthday, and it was the tour for this album. They played at the House of Blues here. And I remember all four of them came out and they were all wearing shirts from the band, The Darkness,
okay.
which I thought was awesome. And that was right when that record was like at the biggest apex and had blown up all over the place. So I thought that was pretty hilarious. And then they were all riffing off it all night.
Yeah, they did have a pretty wide net. Like I remember when I was in high school, like there was a lot of kids wearing Linkin Park shirts one day, and then they're also wearing Coheed shirts the next day. I think they actually did a tour together too. Like it was around like the Minutes to Midnight era Linkin Park, so like 07. But like it was interesting how like it was a band that could be like on modern rock radio for a hot minute. They still kind of are sometimes, at least their last record, but it's not a band you would expect, especially like from like where they started.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they played like an Ozfest or something. Like they had those kind of riffs and stuff that they would appeal to those, to like more metal kids. But like I could see them being like a band that people buy their shirts at Hot Topic too. Like they kind of
their shirts were definitely at Hot Topic, no question.
they were able to kind of fit in a couple different lanes at the same time and kind of, and I don't think that they cared. Like I think lots of these bands I think kind of maybe started in smaller scenes, but that wasn't necessarily what they like aspired to do. It was just because there was a scene where they lived, and they were part of the Jersey scene too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't think that they were like punk kids. I think that they were like guitar kids, and they grew up and they just kind of got fit in with those bands. And then, you know, they became this big, huge, giant band for a while.
It's funny, like the first Coheed record, there's parts of it that remind me of like Clarity Jimmy world.
Yeah, absolutely. And when that's, you can like see, there was enough back then, someone would come out with a record, and then 6 months later, you could like hear the influence across the board on all these other bands. Or, you know, somebody would use a certain type of pedal or a certain type of sound. And then you feel like, because all the bands were listening to that record and they were like, oh man. And they would, you know, kind of emulate it a little bit. So it's like boundary pushing stuff that was really cool.
And like, there's a few songs where it's like 1 minute, it sounds like it's got like the twinkle guitar riffs. And the next thing you know, there's like this banshee scream on it. Like Coheed always did that when, like on the early records, like it wasn't like screaming like post-hardcore. It was just like this weird, like almost like a dragon sound or something.
I know what you mean. Yeah, exactly.
Coheed did. I just Googled Coheed and Slipknot because I remember they toured with Slipknot. It was way back in 08, it appears. Maybe 2000. It was 2009. Because the article is that they talked about it being a very tough gig for Coheed to open for Slipknot because the Slipknot fans are an intense bunch, we'll say. And that their dream is touring with the Foo Fighters, which is interesting. I guess I'll have to look that up at some point.
Coheed's was?
Yeah. At least Claudio Sanchez's. I don't know if he's speaking for...
well, because Taylor Hawkins.
Taylor Hawkins played with them. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Sky Point Taylor Hawkins.
It's Taylor Hawkins and Chris from Dillinger played in that band for a hot minute.
All right, well, like this has been a blast. I feel like we could sit here for another 3 hours and just name some albums, but I really quickly, if we just want to go around the room and do one or two, if you had a quick couple of honorable mentions and a few things to say about them really quick, because I'm sure there's plenty we missed. I also have a few submissions from Mill, who was trying to get out of work to join us, but unfortunately could not, but I have some suggestions from him. So, Corey, did you have any honorable mentions you wanted to get to here?
Yeah, just a couple. One of them is Opeth Damnation. It was Opeth's like softer album, like basically a prog rock record, but it's one that I go back to a lot. It's really relaxing to listen to, and I think, and it's always like just really easy to listen to. Rise Against Revolutions Per Minute, that's another one that like kind of got me started on the whole punk rock journey. This and Suffer and the Witness, but like Revolutions Permitted has Black Mass and Gasoline, which in my opinion, top five opening song of all time.
All right. Any others or was it just those two?
A couple others. I can do a couple others. Yeah. Bleeding Through. This Is Love. This Is Murderous. Bleeding Through is probably my favorite, like of the metalcore bands. And this isn't my favorite Bleeding Through record, but it has like enough classics on there that I go back to it. Another one, this is one that I didn't start listening to until a few years ago, but Fever to Tell by Yeah Yeah Yeahs, which okay. I didn't listen to this record really or this band at all until like the COVID shutdown. And I was just listening to a lot more music then. And I don't know, I kind of just have like, I think of this record a lot because like, I don't know, COVID was tough on everybody. Like you're around like you and your significant other all the time trapped in the house. And my wife and I started going kayaking to kind of just get out of the house to do something. And it really helped us like kind of get over a hump in that spring. And I was listening to this record like every day just because I don't know. I was trying to listen to stuff from back then that I hadn't really given a chance to, and this is one that really kind of stuck with me. And I think that's enough.
All right. No, because I feel like I made a list of like 15 altogether here, and we got to some of them, and I think this just speaks to how big of a musical year and time that was in this world. That there's so many albums to talk about. Eric, what about you?
Yeah, I got a couple ones quick. Exit English by Strike Anywhere. Strike Anywhere, such a cool band, such an underrated band. And this is a fantastic record. And the opening two songs of that, I still like get goosebumps whenever I hear them. Small Brown Bike is another band I really liked. They had a record called The Riverbed that was really good. I have to give a little bit of a shout out. One of my friends is in a band called Much the Same, and they put out a record called Quitters Never Win that came out then. That was a really good one. And then the opposite, a big thumbs down. Every once in a while, I'll be like, is that Saves the Day and Reverie record really that bad? And I'll try to listen to it again. And yes, it is still really that bad. and I'm really glad no one brought up Brand New at all, because fuck that dude forever. He's a gigantic piece of crap. So
yeah, actually, this is where I was going to bring that band up, because Jesse Lacey's been proven to be every bit the terrible person he sounded like lyrically on the Your Favorite Weapon album, because all of the songs are just him crying about various girls that didn't like him, and he decided to make an entire record, and just the way he wrote about them, like in hindsight, like this is some really childish shit that he wrote in these songs. And it's really like that is that band has become one of the litmus tests for me personally of the separation of the art and the artist, because I still really like a lot of those songs, and I'm not going to tell you I don't listen to them, because I definitely do, but it's also really tough when you know the story about the lead singer, the stories about the lead singer. So I don't know what to say other than that. Yeah, but that's like, that was an album that I know I listened to a ton back in the day. And well, still, honestly, did you have any other errors? Any others, Eric? I don't know why that was so hard for me to say.
Okay. That was it.
All right. Well, I got a few from Mill that I wanted to throw out, bring it back to some local guys. Take This to Your Grave by Fall Out Boy. Just a great pop punk album. Still doesn't sound dated, and really kind of bridge the gap from Saves the Day and Newfound Glory. And Mill called it a front to back solid pop punk record. I don't think anyone could disagree. And an album that's another album I feel like I became aware of Fall Out Boy like everybody else with Out From Under the Cork Tree, or whatever that album was called, something like that. And then I went back to that album like, this, I feel like this one's better than this one, but whatever. And then because we mentioned the When We Were Young festival, I feel like we were contractually obligated to mention that Ocean Avenue by Yellow Card is 20 years old now, because that album was so popular, the band came back to do another tour after breaking up initially, it seemed like, which more power to them, because I'm sure they're going to sell it everywhere, because everyone knows Ocean Avenue, I feel like.
I feel like they've broken up and gotten back together three times by now.
Yeah, exactly.
Funny. Thing about Yellow Card, I've never seen them intentionally before, but I've been to Warped Tour, and I feel like every time I've been walking to another stage, I've heard Ocean Avenue at least two or three times, just from like them playing on the main stage when I was walking around.
I've got a good Yellow Card story for off the air, if you're interested.
Oh, all right, great. That'll be the fun post show. Let's see, he also mentions, Mill also referenced the When Broken Is Easily Fixed by Silverstein, which, Corey, I think we have to at least make one Silverstein reference here, because that's how we initially came to know of each other's existence, was through Shane's podcast. So
there you go. That's like the one record by them I'd never listen to, just because of how like rough on the edges it is. But like, I actually tried to listen to it when you said we were doing 2003 records, just to like give like Silverstein a shout out, and I tried. I was just like, I just cannot do this.
All right, well we got there in the end. And the last, I have one more honorable mention here, because I crossed off most of the list already. It's the album's called Between the Never and the Now by Vendetta Red, which I'm not gonna claim that I listened to the album a ton, but the song Shatterday is incredible. And to bring this back to hockey momentarily, if you played NHL 2004, on the soundtrack was a bunch of songs. There's a Deftone song, Quiet Things That No One Ever Knows, was on there from Deja Entendu, and there was, I believe, an Alien Ant Farm song, and I want to say Sing the Sorrow from AFI was on there as well. But if you win the Stanley Cup in that game, after they do the cup presentation and show, like they do the team photo, they go player to player in the video or on your screen. They zoom in on each player and they show the players' stats in the postseason. And the whole time you're doing that, it's playing Shatterday in the background, which is a really good song for that, like for like a championship video montage type of thing. So if any of you have NHL 2004 for your PlayStation 2 or your emulator, go dig that out. It's I guess like a hidden track to be able to hear that song. So
I remember that song like so vividly for whatever reason, and I know nothing else about that band except for Shatterday.
I'm exactly in the same place. I had to Google the name of the record to figure it out today, or look it up on Spotify because I did not know it.
But yeah, that Deftones record was on my list too. I forgot to mention it though. Yeah. That's also one of my favorite metal albums.
Yeah, so the self-titled one.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that record. Well, I like almost everything by the Deftones, but yeah.
Same here. All right. Well, this was a blast. I hope everyone appreciates it. I mean, we might do some more, or maybe we'll just do this every summer. Next year, we can do all the 2004 records as a 20-year flashback. But Corey, thank you so much for hanging out, being incredibly generous with your time. I know we went a little long, but it was a lot of fun. And we're going to get you to be the not only the hockey sack guru, but also the music guru of hockey Twitter. So that's our plan. And we need everyone to know.
Yeah, I'll try to live up to the second one.
All right. Well, yeah. Corey, thanks again for your time. Thanks again to you for listening. And we'll got some more Friday shows coming up for you. So keep an eye to the Second City Hockey airwaves, and we'll have more for you as we continue through the rest of the offseason. And we'll talk to you then.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.